The human spirit is unconquerable. We are individuals and we are sovereign, born with unlimited potential, gifted from our creator. Our mission is to break free from the systems that bind us.
I volunteer as tribute.
We strive for peace and prosperity and overcome all challenges, roadblocks, and obstacles. We are empowered because we think for ourselves and we act for ourselves. We are self-reliant and independent, but guided by the wisdom of those who share our values.
What possible difference can I make?
There is no government, no ruler, nor ideas that are able to stop us. We are driven to succeed because we seek political freedom, financial freedom, and spiritual freedom.
It's all for nothing if you don't have freedom.
This is Mike Corbell, and you are listening to The Invictus Mind. Well, hey, welcome back to another episode of the Invictus Mind podcast, the number one show dedicated to becoming unconquerable. As always, this is your host, Mike Corbell, and I'm happy to be here and happy for the listeners. I am very excited to have my guest joining me today. He was one of the first people I thought of when I decided to start this podcast. He's best known for his charisma, his business acumen, and practical wisdom to simplify often very complicated ideas. He currently runs a business consulting practice out of New York City. But he made his name known in libertarian circles when he ran for vice president and eventually was a candidate for the governor of New York in 2018, where he won more than any other votes in previous Libertarian Party history. You can check him out on YouTube as he is a host of a nightly program called The Sharp Way. So please let me introduce Mr. Larry Sharp. How are you doing today, Larry?
How are you, sir? With that intro, I better be good, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
I gotta say something smart now. Okay, it's fine.
Well, Larry, I don't think that'll be a problem. You know, you probably don't remember because you've met thousands of people from the time I first met you till now. But you met me and my then girlfriend, now wife, in Chicago in 2017.
Nice. Yes, that was the Illinois State Convention, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
You were the guest speaker there and you entertained the crowd as you were doing an auction for some of the old libertarian books that they had and patchwork artwork they had.
I remember we did a fundraiser. Absolutely. Yeah. I raised money for the Illinois LP that night. I remember. Yes, absolutely. I met a lot of people. I spent a lot of time in the hotel lobby talking to people.
Right on. Yeah. We were there for you for a couple hours after the convention ended. So that was great.
I remember. Yeah, that was good. I enjoyed that tremendously.
So awesome. You know, when I invited you on, my wife was more excited for you to come on my program than any other guest I've had. And I've had some pretty big names on already. But, you know, I think that you are the kind of person that's suitable for this show.
I appreciate it. Tell me about what the show, what is your audience looking for? Tell me.
Well, this is the Invictus Mind. So I help people understand how to become unconquerable. And what I mean by that is achieving freedom. We talk about political freedom, financial freedom, and we talk about spiritual freedom.
So let me tell you what is the number one issue when it comes to being unconquerable.
Okay.
And the number one word you have to think about here is not intelligence, not savvy, not strength, none of those things. The number one thing is resilience. Mm-hmm. That is the number one piece. You have to be resilient because no matter how good or smart or cool you are or think you are, sometimes those things match, often they don't. But what doesn't matter, the point is you will have setbacks. You will lose. You will fail. You will do all those things. You will have people betray you. You will have things, you will have luck go against you. That's going to happen. And generally speaking, the more you try to achieve, the more failures you'll have. And the harder those falls will be. It's a good general rule. The question is, when you fall down, do you get back up? And when you fall down, have you created two things? One, your own mental, spiritual personality that will allow you to get up. And two, do you have a community or a social structure or a network that will help you get up? If you can do those two things, you can become unconquerable.
All right, so you'll get your paycheck in the mail for the advertising. Awesome. You know, Larry, you're very known to have very often practical and pragmatic solutions in the political world, and I'm guessing that you talk a lot about that on your show. You'll have to forgive me. I've known you for a couple of years, but I haven't watched every episode of your show. But I definitely know
I do too many of them. I do a show I produce about 8 to 10 hours of live content every single week. You can't watch it all. You just can't. You can't have a life and do it. You can't. It's impossible.
But, you know, when we first met you, one of the things that I really loved was just your background, your story.
Thank you.
My wife grew up in New York, and I had only been to that state one time. When we were married in 2018, you were on your campaign trail, so there was no way I was going to meet you. But that was the first time I went to New York City, and it may be the last time. I don't know. But I love to hear your story just about what it's like growing up in New York.
Well, the thing about New York that most people don't get, it's similar in a way to Illinois, right? It's similar in that there's one big city, right? Illinois has one big city, and then the rest of the state is not the same as the city. Mm-hmm. We have a similar situation in New York, except ours goes South City, North Country. Yours is kind of South Country, North City, right? Right. But it's a similar environment. But what I think is special about New York, several things. One, New York City is a place where you can get anything you want. One third of people who live in New York City are not born in the country. Mm. Another one third are not born in the city. So that means most people who are currently living in New York City aren't native to New York. And that's a very interesting dynamic. It's a very interesting way of looking at life and looking at things. And it's glorious to kind of accept that as one massive city. But not just that. The metro area, New York City, is about 16 million people in the metro area. That's larger than most countries, right? Just New York City's 8.5 million people is larger than about 40 states. So it's a big, big state, a big, big city. Now you leave New York City. Now you have everything else you could imagine. You like skiing. Yep. You like mountains. Yep. You like rivers. Yep. You like lakes. Yep. You like falls, beaches, forest, farmland, whatever you like. We got it in New York State. New York State has everything you could imagine, from the largest city in the world, which is going to give you the New York Yankees. It's going to give you Madison Square Garden. It's going to give you Broadway, history, Statue of Liberty, Freedom Tower, whatever is your thing. You like, you know, classical music. You want to watch a ballet. Oh, my God. Whatever is your thing, you have it in New York City. And then anything that's outdoorsy, you have it either on Long Island or upstate New York. You've got it all. The problem is our government. Mm-hmm. We love our great, amazing, diverse state. We just hate our government. Now, our government is supposed to be a Democrat government that cares about diversity and such. That is what they're supposed to be. And I get that. That sounds great. Let's see it in practice. It's not. In practice, we are a one state, well, one party rule state, which everything starts from our capital, Albany, and then goes every place else. Mm. And if you actually respect diversity, and I would hope you do, diversity is awesome, then you have to act accordingly and allow local people to be local, to understand that the big city is not what the rural areas are. They're different. They're diverse. So let them be different. The people who live in Brooklyn, they love Brooklyn. I never forget, I had a guest on my show once. He said, Brooklyn is a blood type. That's what he said, because he loves Brooklyn. And right. That's awesome. If you love Brooklyn, live in Brooklyn. Enjoy it. That's who you are. Awesome. But if you live in a farmland upstate New York, in Wyoming County or in Herkimer County or someplace upstate New York, and you love that place, good on you. Love, you know, live wherever you love and live the way you want to live. Me growing up in New York City as a kid, I grew up in a poor neighborhood. Grew up in the Bronx, South Bronx in the 70s and 80s. And if any of you know about the 70s, the Bronx was not the best neighborhood. Literally, the old movie about corrupt cops called Serpico that came out in the 60s was shot in my neighborhood. So that's how bad our neighborhood was. The corrupt cop movie of the 70s was shot in my neighborhood. That's how bad it was. It was a bad neighborhood, a rough neighborhood. Cabs wouldn't come to my neighborhood. That's how bad it was. So we had gypsy cabs. There was no Uber or Lyft back then, right? It didn't exist. Right. So we had gypsy cab. People would spray paint one of their doors a certain color. And we all knew, oh, okay, that's gypsy cab. You go in his car and he would take you someplace. Girls would be outside on the stoop. And for those who know what a stoop is, in the city, it's the stairway that goes up to the lobby where you go into the apartment buildings.
Okay.
So they'd be sitting on a stoop braiding hair for like 50 cents or a dollar. They'd braid hair to make money. And back in the day, they used to repair cars out front. Guys would come out, and back in those days, cars made of metal. Not anymore, right? But they would be banging out dents and you know, repolishing cars and such. There was a hustle, an entrepreneurial spirit that was part of the poor communities. And that's how people got out of poor communities, right? Is by doing that. We have stifled that since then. Mm-hmm. My parents got me out of the Bronx because my mom used to clean office buildings and houses. I would help her as a kid. And my father was a DJ and he'd do it on the weekends. And they would pack up. And eventually we got out and got to Long Island. which for those of you who don't know, Long Island is a suburb of New York City, and it's a better lifestyle than the Bronx. Was it amazing? It's middle class. You know, but like I moved to Beverly Hills. Yeah. But for me, coming out of the Bronx, it might as well have been Beverly Hills, if that makes any sense. It might as well have been that, because it was a big difference. And moving out there is where I saw a different lifestyle. My father passed away right after that. He died of cancer. And when he died, my mother was in a very bad place. She was an immigrant, and her family was in Europe still. And my father's family abandoned us. And then after that, all of a sudden, I went from having a larger family to having just me and my mom. Mm. And it was tough for me. I was 12. And it's very difficult. And my mom couldn't handle it. And I just wanted to get out. So we were poor. I didn't have any money. So at 17, I joined the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Left, joined the Marines. And my mom couldn't handle it. My father's death, loneliness, me leaving was too much. And my mom was addicted first to legal drugs and eventually illegal drugs. And she was then eventually a victim of the drug war. And she was a convicted felon and went to prison. Hmm. And the weird part is, my father, before he passed, was a corrections officer at Rikers Island.
Really?
Yeah. So I've seen it from both sides. Okay. I've seen the corrections officer side, and I've seen the inmate side. I've seen both in my own family. So when I came out of the Marine Corps, I had to get my mom out of prison, of course. So I pulled her out and I tried to, you know, kind of get her back up and running, right? Took some of my savings, got her a car, got an apartment. And it made me realize that. And for those of you who are listening or watching, when you have an addict in your life and they have a choice of choosing their substance of choice or you, you lose. That's how that works. That's sure. Why they're an addict. That's how that works. And it's hard for most people to understand. Me as a teenage boy, that was hard for me. I was very bitter. Mm. I didn't get it. I was too naive to understand that. But by the time I'd gotten out, I'd seen issues and stuff in the Marine Corps. I'd seen things. I loved my mother. I realized she was the only one for me. There was no one else in our life but me and her. So I went back to help her out. And I also learned something, is that if you want someone to not be an addict or not be self-destructive with any substance, jail isn't the answer. Punishment isn't the answer. The only possible answer is support. Mm-hmm. And that may not work, right? Support isn't a cure-all, but support is the only chance. And I gave my mom that support structure to get her back up and running,
right,
and back in action. And without my support, she would have fallen right back into old ways, as many people do. But what I noticed when she was, you know, back and having a job is she was a hostage. Our system is very cruel to felons, ex-offenders. We don't believe in second chances. It's not a thing that America, we talk it, but we don't actually believe in it. Yeah. Our system is completely against second chances. So my mom did her time, paid her debt to society, and was out. So she should have been okay, right? No. She was always a hostage. She had to lie on every form saying she wasn't a felon. Why? Because she had wanted to get a job and had to survive. And if you're a felon, they go, no, I'm not going to hire you. So she had to lie and hope that they wouldn't find out and fire her. She wouldn't, you know, fight her boss or try to make changes because she was a hostage. And I hated it. And I said, how am I going to make it to where my mom is not a hostage? Here's what I do. I'll start a business. And we started a business. That's how I became an entrepreneur. We started a trucking company, my mom, me, and at that point, my stepdad. And we started a business, a trucking business, and she had 100% ownership. She owned all of it.
That's great.
I ran it and she owned everything. And the reason why I wanted to own everything was because if she's the owner, nobody can fire you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hostage problem solved. There's no more hostage here.
Yeah, I like how you use the word hostage. And even under normal circumstances, when somebody doesn't have a criminal record or anything, I think of the word job, J-O-B, jail of the brokenhearted. And so you're kind of a hostage. You don't really have freedom because, you know, when you have a job, you have someone's thumb over your head. You got to be there at a certain time. You got to perform certain duties. They don't often pay you what you're worth. And, you know, just having that hostility right there because you're not working for yourself, I don't think you have freedom. So that's why I love entrepreneurs. I mean, I'm really attracted to your story.
And, yes. And I did it for that, to your point. I didn't want her to be a hostage.
Yeah.
And the thing I'll bring up with any job or any business, it's a mindset. Mm-hmm. And the mindset you want to have, and this is a problem with many people who become entrepreneurs, there is an employee mindset and an entrepreneur mindset. And the employee mindset says, I worked hard, I deserve money. Or I showed up, I deserve money. That's how most people who have jobs think, and that's how they get paid. That makes total sense. But when you're an entrepreneur, it doesn't matter how hard you work or what you think you deserve. If you don't close deals, you don't get paid.
Right.
Period. That's it. I hope you work hard and there's value in working hard, but you can work as hard as you want. If you don't close deals, you don't get paid. If you don't provide value, you don't get paid. Period. That is a massive mindset change for people. And many entrepreneurs fail because they're busy. And they think if they're busy, then they're going to get money. No, you're not. You've got to make sure that you're being effective and providing value. And you want to think that way as an employee. Because if you think that way as an employee, to your point, you will command more money and you will demand more money because you're thinking that way. And most people don't think that way. Therefore, they just go, you know, they're not hiring. That's it. Or they're not giving raises. That's it. And I, when I talk to people about this, I say, why do I care? So what do you mean? Why do I care if they're giving? They're the only person here that matters.
All right.
They're like, they're not. Then I don't care. That's their policy. So what's your policy? Mm-hmm. Their policy isn't law. It's just stuff they said.
Yeah.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. So I've gone to places more than once and cold called for a job. They didn't have anything in the paper saying that they wanted a job or they had anything online saying they want a job. I just went there saying I want to work there. And I've cold called my old job more than once. And people say, well, they're not hiring. I don't care. Well, they don't want to pay money. That's not my concern. My concern is what I want to bring. And that's how you come across. And absolutely. I'm not saying being arrogant. Arrogance is a bad thing. You do not want to come across as arrogant. You just want to be confident and you want to talk to your employer or your boss or the entrepreneur in a way that says, I have value. Do you want that value? If you don't, no worries, man. We're good. You don't want my value. It's all good. I'm not mad. If you want my value, this is what it's worth. This is what it costs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that should be the style, obviously in your own words, but that mindset changes, right? I remember, I'll tell you this story. How I became a coach. I didn't want to be a coach. Never want to be a coach. I was gonna be a trainer. That was what I was gonna. Mm-hmm. I was gonna be a trainer to train people. And I'm sitting here at a bank, doing a training for a bunch of investment bankers, not retail bankers, investment bankers. You'll make tons of money. But it was my first investment bank deal. I'd never been in investment banking before, so I didn't know the field very well at all. Mm. I'd only done retail banking and then small businesses. When I was growing my business in 2004. Almost all of my customers were small businesses. Why? No one else would trust me, right? I was a small fry. Why? I had no track record. What big business would hire me? They wouldn't, right. But the small guys would. So I built my business on entrepreneurs and one-person shops, three-person shops like that. All of a sudden, now I'm in a major bank, right? Mm-hmm. Big investment bank. I'm doing my training. So at the end, one of the guys comes to me and goes, hey, Larry, you're not really like a sales trainer. You're more like an influence trainer. I think you could help me personally. I'm like, sure, of course I could. Yeah, of course. He goes, I want you to coach me personally. Now, a thing that I've always talked about and I still talk about, you will almost never hear me say no to anybody. Mm. I rarely say no. What I would do is price people out.
There you go.
So if you say, Larry, I need you to come to Illinois and wash my car every Tuesday. 100%, man. I will totally come wash your car. Absolutely. I'll bring my own soap, $10,000 every week. And you're going to go, I don't make $10,000. Oh, okay. I would do it, but that's the price. No worries. Still love you, man. We're good.
Sure.
Right. But the price I use is a price that I would, if you actually want to give me $10,000, I would actually come wash your car. I'm just saying, I would pick a price that if the person says yes, that I'll actually do it. Right. But I'm going to pick a price that's so outlandish that it's worth whatever other thing I have to deal with. If someone says, Larry, you wash that guy's car? Yes. For $10,000. Oh my God. Can I come? That's what happens. Right. So I did the same thing with him. I said, yeah, 100%. And again, I didn't want to be a coach. I said, I need $5,000 up front. It's monthly. We'll meet whenever I have a chance. And I can't guarantee anything. Now, what small business entrepreneur would say yes to that? None. There's not one small business entrepreneur in the world who will go, sure, $5,000 up front and no guarantees and every month. No small business owner says yes to that. That's what I was accustomed to. I assumed he would say no. I didn't realize he's a heavy hitter banker who makes $3 million a year. Mm. $5,000 to him is no big deal if he knows he can close one deal. I help him close one deal, he makes $250,000. So he was like, okay. He said, okay, he pulled his checkbook out. And I was like, oh, guess I'm a coach.
That's a confidence booster right there.
Guess I'm a coach now. And that's how I became a coach. So, okay. But why was I able to pull that off? Because I had the confidence to say I have value.
Right.
And if you want my value, it's fine, but you got to pay for it. And if you don't want it, no worries. Like, I wasn't angry or annoyed. It was just, you want it or you don't, it's fine. And I think that would, my mindset is what got me that deal. It wasn't necessarily my skill set.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in my career teaching people to make a transition from having an employment situation to actually becoming entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. I was a recruiter for a financial company for a long time. And that mindset, that's is 90% of the effort right there.
Yes.
If you can think about what value you have to provide, then you go out there and your confidence automatically starts to boost. It's
an amazing thing. Here's an exercise that the people who are listening to can use. And it's a serious exercise. Sit with someone that knows them. Doesn't matter who it is, whether it could be personal, professional, whatever, can be a coach, can be you, whomever. And you say to yourself, all right, the last time you were proud of your job, is that this job, a job before, whatever they say. Oh no, this job. Okay, great. So let me ask you, who's your customer? Like, who are you servicing? Ask that question. And they might say, well, I'm internal. I really, you know, I deal with internal customers. I support HR or I support IT or whatever. Or it might be client facing. Or no, I support the customer, blah, 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 whatever. And so a customer can be internal or external, right? Maybe you're executive assistant. Your client might be your boss, right? That might be your client directly, your boss. Depends on what it is. But you have the conversation. Who's your client? And once they go, oh, this is my client. Okay, great. I'm going to ask you a question. If you're really good at what you do, how does your client benefit? And when they say, so like, well, they'll make more money. No. I mean, like, personally, how do they really benefit? How do they benefit? And then the person was going to say, well, you know, because I support IT as an example, maybe they're HR and they support IT and recruiting. I'm making that up, right? That's their job. And they go, look, if I'm really good at what I do, they're able to go home on time because they get the right people. And they're actually able to learn more skill sets because they're not fixing problems. They're actually doing new stuff. And you walk them through the benefits of what someone gets when they're good at what they do. And you will watch their eyes open up. And they're like, wow, I do provide value. Yeah, you do. You provide more value than just a paycheck. You provide more value than checking a box.
Right.
That's and brilliant. Then the opposite. What if you're bad at what you do? What happens if you're terrible at it? How are they affected? Well, they'll fire me. No. I mean the people who's your client. What happens when you're bad at what you do? And they go, well, if I'm bad, then, I mean, they get nothing done because this is happening and that's happening. Oh, so you are important. That small exercise with any individual employee, with you and them or their friends and them or whatever, is going to help to put the light on in their head to go, man, I am valuable. Yeah, you are. Don't just think you're worth the hourly rate or the monthly salary or whatever you're giving. That's something. That's part of what you're worth. Sure, that's a part of it, but that isn't all of it.
Yeah, that reminds me of a parable I heard one time. You might have been familiar with this one. There was three guys sitting outside of a cathedral at Notre Dame, and they were actually constructing it. Mm-hmm. And the first guy's like, okay, what do you do? And he's like, I make $20 an hour. And the second guy's like, well, I'm making a church. And the other guy is like, no, I'm making a cathedral to the heavenly God. And, he's demonstrating his big vision. When you know your value, you know, you feel better about it. You can communicate better. You can do well in a job and have the right mindset to get into entrepreneurism.
100%. I heard a similar story. The story I heard was it's almost the same, but I'm going to tell you the different way I heard it. There's three people who are laying bricks.
Yeah.
And you go to the first guy and say, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm laying bricks. Go to the second guy, what are you doing? Oh, I'm building a wall. Oh, third guy, what are you doing? I'm building a school.
Yeah.
And they're all doing the same job. But how does each person think about what they're doing? One person says, I'm laying bricks. It's accurate, but they're to your point. I'm $20 an hour, right? The other person building a wall. Better, right? Better, but not there yet, right? But better, that's a good transition. And the last person's like, I'm building a school. Nice. Now we're looking at things, right? That's the way to look at things. Absolutely.
So now, did you get that mindset shift on your first experience with business, or is that something you got younger in your life? Or
I didn't know that I had it until I went back to work.
Okay.
Right? If that makes any sense. I wish I was savvy and I'd figured it out right away. I didn't. When I left the Marine Corps, I became a teacher. I changed from being a teacher to being an entrepreneur with my mom. And then I went and became a sales rep.
Okay.
And when I was a sales rep, that's when I began to realize, oh, no, I need to be an entrepreneur. That's when I realized, when I went back to work, I didn't realize there was a change in me during my time working with my mom, making that business up. I didn't know that it happened. It happened then, but I didn't recognize it.
Did you have some kind of mentorship, or, you know, a lot of people have coaches that they see? I mean, back in the day, probably not online, but people like Zig Ziglar and Tom Hopkins and all the great gurus out there. Did you have something like that in your life?
Initially, no. Initially, it was all just what the hell, go try stuff. It was all trial and error up initially. But after, when I started becoming a sales rep, I started rethinking things, thinking about books to buy, thinking a bit more, but I still was never that good. And then I had a mentor when I was at a sales job. And the guy's name was Mo. Mo didn't know he was my mentor. He didn't know it, but he changed my life tremendously. And I got to give some credit to the Marine Corps for this one. Mo was very vulgar. He was a vice president of the sales force. Very vulgar, screaming nasty words, insulting people. He was an ex-Saudi expat who had to leave Saudi Arabia because he was an officer and he was part of some coup against the guys. They got rid of him. He'd leave his family behind. Terrible story. He came to work and became a good sales rep. And he was his military presence was clear, and he was very vulgar and aggressive. Most of the sales reps didn't like it, couldn't hear him. He was giving us gold. But I was lucky. I was a Marine.
Yeah.
I had heard that all my Marine Corps life, right?
You just brush it off, right?
Exactly. That kind of vulgarity and aggressiveness was like, whatever. It didn't mean anything to me.
Sure.
So I actually heard him. And he was the first person to tell me that sales is only about emotion. That sales is about trust and feelings and things like that. He goes, everything else is just stuff. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get that. Now it's so obvious to me, but then I didn't get it. I needed someone to slap me and go, hey, wake up. This is the reality. And he gave me a couple of books to read and he started showing me what to do. And man, he was my mentor and it was great. And I built my entire sales process that I still teach to this day based upon my time with him.
Okay.
So he was a mentor, but he didn't know he was. He was just doing his job and I was the only guy listening. Mm. So he wound up becoming a mentor for me unknowingly. And he was the one who put me on the path. But I think one of my best mentors, who wasn't an actual mentor. I had no physical mentors except for him. He was my physical mentor, but not knowing. But people who I read, I was never a big fan of the Zig Ziglars and the Tony Robbins of the world because I thought they were nice, but I thought they were much more about motivation and not inspiration.
Okay.
And motivation, they even tell you, motivation, you got to get motivated every day. That's not enough for me. I need to be inspired. I need to wake up without needing the motivation to get up and get going. Mm-hmm. And that's what I had in the Marine Corps, right? The Marine Corps is every day you get up and go do stuff. And I still think that way. Like, I remember I was talking to a friend of mine once and I said, you know, every day I'm at war. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, that's terrible. I said, no, it's glorious. It's why I get up in the morning.
Sure.
When the war is over, put me in a box. Right. I want to have something to do. I want to have some place to go. I want to have purpose to get up in the morning and put my boots on and get back into the field. If I don't have a purpose, what am I doing? Put me in a box then. I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how I always want to be. I want to be the place where I'm inspired to keep going. And I try my best to inspire people so that when I'm gone, they are still moving forward. I learned in the Marine Corps that when the captain gets shot, you still got to take the hill. If I'm a good leader, then when I take a round and they got to pull me out medevac, my unit can still function. Yeah. If my unit can't function, I'm a terrible leader. So the goal of good leaders is to create more leaders. The goal of good leaders is to always inspire people to do the right thing always. And that's what I try to do. I try. Clearly, I'm just human and I fail, but I try. And in my own world, I'm trying to be inspired and to inspire others that when I'm not there, when you tell me things like you still remember when we chat and talk, you make my day. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to think, oh, it's fleeting, that Larry guy, whatever. I want them to remember it. I do. And I want them to be inspired while I'm gone. I can't see everybody all the time. It's impossible.
Sure.
So I want to be able to be impactful when I'm there. So as I started going through those books, I was never really into most of those guys. One guy I was into, though, a guy named Robert Ringer.
I haven't heard
Robert
that.
Ringer. He wrote the book Looking Out for Number One. Nothing happens until someone moves action. And he wrote To Be or Not to Be Intimidated. He's an objectivist. I'm not an objectivist, but he is. And he was the person who got me even close to the Libertarian Party. Because for those who don't know, objectivism and libertarianism, they have some overlap.
Sure.
Not exactly the same, but they have overlap. And he was the one who basically told me, you should read things like, you know, Atlas Shrugged and such. So I started building a lot of my thought process from Robert Ringer. Now, only Robert Ringer, I never met him. I only read his books and his blogs and stuff like that. So I guess he was a distance mentor, perhaps. But he was talking about things like how to change your brand, how to change how people view you. Mm-hmm. His book, To Be or Not to Be Intimidated, talks about how he was a commercial realtor, real estate broker, and how all he did was change his branding and he tripled his income.
Yep.
And that was the stuff I was talking about. How do people, this went right in line with what Mo was telling me about. It's the image that matters, the feeling that matters, the confidence level that matters, all those things. So the Marine Corps gave me resilience already. And then these people gave me the idea of mindset change. And I think that's how I was able to keep going.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked a little bit about identifying as a trainer, but then really becoming a coach. Now, there is a distinctive difference between those two words. A trainer, like you said, is somebody I can teach you. I could be a trainer at Burger King and teach you how to make a Whopper.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But a coach is somebody like a stage coach that actually carries you forward. That's what that word means. So when you carry people and you change their lives, then you really do become a coach. And I think that you've demonstrated that. And now with your consulting practice, NeoSage, right?
Well, that's the funny part you brought up. I never wanted to be a coach.
Yeah.
I'm not in any way certified to be a coach. I never went to school to be a coach. None of that stuff. I didn't want to be one. That wasn't what I wanted to do. But I found myself, again, this goes back to mindset. Because I didn't want to be a coach, people wanted me to coach. So what wound up happening is about maybe 20 to 30% of my business was coaching. And I found myself in my heyday making more money coaching as a side business almost than most actual coaches. Because my prices were by default higher because I didn't want to do it. And people were still paying me. I was still doing it. So I found that that's what wound up happening for me. And I would literally tell people, I was very forward in many ways. In other words, you know, for most people who are coaches, if you work for an organization, HR will be very forward and go, you have to report back to us and give us information. And I would say, no. What? No, I'm not going to report back to you. Why not? Because then they're all going to lie to me. They're all going to lie to me. I'm not going to report back at all. I'm not going to tell you when I'm doing meetings. You're going to know nothing. You're going to know nothing. It'll be over within 6 months. And here's what I promise you. You will either have an obviously better executive or they will leave. That's what I promise you. And what I've done for every time, it's going to sound crazy, is I've done a unconditional money back guarantee. And in the 17 years that I've been in business, I've had to give it back twice. Once was for an online product. The person did not like my online product. And I learned my lesson, never did an online product ever again. So I learned my lesson. Another one was a woman who literally, as I was coaching her, got a job and changed everything. So I just gave her money.
Okay.
It was the only two times I've given my money back in 17 years. And I've always done that. It's literally in my proposal, unconditional. You're not happy, money back. And those two times I've been to give money back. So some HRs will say, no, thank you, Larry. We don't want you. I go, okay, I'm not mad. No worries. But some have said yes. And when they say yes, they work on my terms. I'm not going to, and sometimes people leave. Which is fine because my goal is to make the individual happy. That's always my goal. And sometimes people are in the wrong job. And what you find as a coach often is most employees are not bad employees. Some are, absolutely true, does happen, but most aren't. Most bad employees are in the wrong job. That's the reality. Most are in the wrong job. That's not 100% rule. There are some bad employees, but a lot of times people are just in the wrong job. Most people allow their life to be run by inertia. Whatever's in front of me, I'll take the best thing in front of me. They don't chase anything.
Right.
And when people are failing, and this is one of the things I do when people start coming to me, when they have problems. I say, I don't want you running away from anything. I want you running towards something. If you run away from stuff, you just land wherever. And you want to run away from that too. So now you're running from one and running from another. No, run towards something. Mm-hmm. Even if you're wrong, the concept of having control of where you're running will make you stronger, more resilient, and make you think better.
Yeah. It's better to shoot for the moon and miss than aim for the mud and make it.
Well, the other issue is, do you want the moon? Or do you want Mars? Or do you want the sun? Or do you want a star?
There you go.
All I'm saying is pick the thing you want and go for it, and you might find out. Oh, I'm shooting for the sun. Oh, no. I want the moon. Okay, turn. But still go towards the thing you want, right?
Right.
If you just go, what's in front of me? Oh, there's a cow in front of me. I'll jump on top of the cow. But what if you don't want the cow? I don't mind if you just want the mud, if you want the mud. I mean, that's my issue. Because even if you get a weak success, it's still a success.
Sure.
Right? Sure. So if I am I taking the mud because it's there and it's easy, that's not a success. Mm. Do I actually want to be in the mud? You do. Go for the mud. I got it. I'm in the mud, Larry. Well done. You wanted the mud. You got the mud. What do you want now? Well, now I want the moon. All right, then. Let's go to the moon then.
Right.
So I'll take the mud if you want the mud, not you're taking it because it's the only thing you can get or because the only thing in front of you. Sure, there is the key piece. Are you going for what you want? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. That's an amazing talk right there. You know, I wasn't exactly going to go so much down this road, but I really appreciate it because this is good, insightful stuff.
No, look, I want to make your audience happy, brother. This is your show, not mine. This is yours. I'm going to give your audience what they're looking for.
Well, this is definitely up there. You know, one of the things that I always found is we talked about 90% of what you do in success is your mindset. The other 10% is that dogfight, right? And I'm curious because I know you talk about this a lot just on your show and stuff, but I wanted to talk about the business environment in New York City because, you know,
Do we have to?
Well, if you don't want to, if it's too much of a downer.
I'm teasing. I don't want everyone to just start getting depressed. I just, you know.
Well, the thing is, because that's what I'm interested in, because a lot of people will put up excuses as to why they can't do this, why they can't do that. And it's 90%. Right, of just mindset. But that other 10% is the reality of, you know, there's always regulations, there's the government, there's that, there's this. With some of your consulting clients in New York City, you know, what kind of major obstacles besides just their own mindset and their own, you know, imaging and branding have you seen that's been really difficult? I mean, is it hard or really difficult to get a business in New York City?
Wow. So many pieces to that. Let me be a bit generic, and then be a bit specific and what's actually happening now and then prior to COVID, because there has been a big change in New York City since the COVID lockdowns. Prior to the COVID lockdowns, the reason why New York City was a place to be wasn't because it has a friendly business environment. It is very anti-business. It is basically a communist state. Mm. Everything is based upon punishing the business owner and supporting either the consumer or the tenant or the little guy. That's what it's supposed to be about. But it winds up making everybody mediocre. But that's what it's supposed to be about. But the reason why you didn't care was New York City is a 16 million metro person area. So what does that mean?
There's a market.
It means
there.
That there's talent there. It means that there's customers there. Everything's there. Not just that. Finance is here. All the banks are here. You know, people who are providing startup funds are here. Great schools are here. This is a mecca for female talent, a mecca for foreign talent. You're looking for talent. It's a mecca to come here for that. It's awesome. So people would put up with it because the opportunity was so high. They would put up with the pain because the opportunity was so high. That's gone away. You are going to see New York City struggle tremendously because what companies have realized is I don't have to have that talent in New York City anymore. Mm. I can have it someplace else. It's not required anymore.
Sure.
The Zoom calls that we're doing, right? All those things, working remote, that's crushing New York City. Why would I want to come into this horrible city every day when I could do it from home? And the wealthy are already leaving. Many of my clients, as you know, because I am expensive, many of my clients are at least wealthy, well off, if not wealthy. And many of them have left New York City. If you're wealthy in New York City, for those of your listeners who don't know, you have at least two homes. You have one in New York City and one someplace else, right? Either Florida, Jersey Shore, Connecticut, upstate New York. You have a second home. That's what the wealthy have in New York City. So many of them have gone to their second home, and they went last year. And now they're working and making money from their second home. It's a much nicer lifestyle. Right. A lot of them aren't coming back.
So now you're going to have a bunch of vacancies in the houses in New York City, huh?
But not just that. When the elite people, wealthy, don't come back, all the people who service them don't need to come back either.
Mm.
All the people who work for them don't have to come back either. All those people don't have to come back. You're going to see New York City suffer tremendously in the next coming years. It'll bounce back some, but not that much, because New York City had 8.5 million people. I think it will go under 8 million by the end of this year. I think it'll fall under 7 million within a year and never come back past 7 million. That's my personal view, because I just don't think that, because finance is also leaving. The problem is our New York State government has been so broken and so backward. They don't know any better. They've been pushing out all the cool things. They pushed out cannabis. They pushed out blockchain. They pushed so many things out. And what they haven't realized is back in the day, you go back 20 years ago, tech used to follow finance to chase the money.
Sure.
Those are not true. Now finance follows tech.
Mm.
Tech now leads finance. Finance used to lead tech. It doesn't work anymore. So now look at every major bank in New York City also has a branch in San Francisco, right? The New York Stock Exchange is considering going to Austin, Texas, or Dallas, Texas. The New York Stock Exchange is considering going to Texas, right? So that's what's happening in New York now. So we're struggling. So you might say, well, Larry, how in the world can anybody have a business there? Well, prior to COVID, the number one thing was have a good network where you have a chance to explode and be big. Right. Mm-hmm. That was the goal. Have a network and have a chance of exploding and being big. Have a chance. But I'll go one step further, which is still good now and has been good. Number one, niche. The biggest mistake that small business owners have is they want to cast a wide net. Larry, my product, my service can help anybody. I can help anybody. I'm a financial advisor. I can help anybody. I'm a tech guru. I can help anybody. I'm a web designer. I can do a web for anybody, right? Whatever. I'm a makeup artist. I can do makeup for anybody. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying nobody cares.
Right. There's so much competition out there. And
you want to niche as deep as you possibly can with either people you already know or an industry you already know, preferably both. So let's say I'm going to be a makeup artist and I'm going to start my own makeup artist business. Okay, great. What do you know? Well, I can make up anybody. You're going to suffer. You're in trouble. But you might say, well, you know what I know really well? I know a bunch of, I'm making this up as like an argument, a bunch of YouTubers. I was in the YouTuber world. I know tons of them. Oh, why don't you become a makeup artist for YouTubers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, really? Yeah. Promote yourself as that. I'm a YouTube makeup artist. You're doing a YouTube. You're doing a podcast. You're doing a video podcast. You're doing a YouTube stuff. Let me be your makeup person. I'll make you look just the way you want to, blah, blah, blah. But Larry, I know. Focus on them. Because when you niche into something like that, you become an expert. They'll hear you. And not just that, your marketing message can be direct. If you go, you need to look good, I'll help you. No one hears that.
Yeah.
But if you instead say, are you online almost every day, worried about how people are imagining you, trying not to look too sexy, but not too dumpy, trying to find the right look for your audience, I got you. And they go, oh, that's that what I'm trying to do. And you can even niche it even more. Are you a woman who wants to make sure she looks just attractive enough, but not attracting the wrong kind of, yes. Or are you a male who wants to look attractive, but you don't want to look feminine, or you don't want to look too masculine, or whatever is your world, right? Who are you talking to? Yeah, I do. I got you. Now people say yes to that. And now when you begin to grow in that specific niche, they will refer you outside that niche.
Okay.
And that's how you begin to grow. If you're going to grow a business in today's world, niche. Niche in who you are, niche in who you're talking to, niche in what you know. No, being good at what you do, it's going to sound crazy. You're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not impressed because you're a good makeup artist. You're supposed to be a good makeup artist. That's your job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know the makeup industry. You're supposed to. You're a professional makeup artist. I'm not impressed by that. But you know the online. YouTuber world. Ooh, you're not supposed to know that. That's where you're special. Or she becomes just for I don't know, weddings, brides for weddings. I made that up, whatever, right? You don't have to know the bridal industry to be a makeup artist. You know, makeup industry. You know, the bridal industry. Ooh, now you're a specialist.
Yep.
If you're going to start any new endeavor, niche. Always better to be big fish, small pond.
That makes perfect sense. Now, I'm guessing just based on what you said that COVID hasn't really affected your business too much because of that very mindset right there.
No, it affected me tremendously. It changed everything for me.
Did it? Okay.
Yeah. Remember, coaching was a small part of my business. I'm a teacher too. I teach classes at Columbia, Baruch, Yale. So teaching, consulting with larger organizations. Prior to COVID, I would be an executive in a public company, take over for a short period of time while they find new people. And what I would do, and it's something else for you to consider for those of you who are starting businesses. If you want to get into anything new, make it very easy for people to say yes to you.
Okay.
So I was training and teaching leadership. That's what happened after 2008. I got my butt kicked 2008 bad, 2009 badly. I had to reboot my entire business model. That's my resilience piece I talked to about. I had to reboot everything. I had to fire my employees. I had an office on Third Avenue with the training facility in it. Had to shut it all down, fire my employees, reboot everything. I went from sales trainer and coach to leadership trainer overnight. So I thought, I'm a leadership trainer. Well, I got a problem. Because when I was a sales trainer, I had experience, hardcore experience in selling. So I could train and then give actual examples of what I had done. I wasn't just some ivory tower egghead. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have big leadership. My last leadership was really as a chief instructor. At that point, it was 10, 20 years ago. And as a Marine, which was like 10, 20 years ago, wasn't effective. So I said, I have to be able to be a leader in large organizations. So what did I do? Literally, there was a public company that had just lost one of their major leaders. And I said, I'll fill their shoes temporarily. What? Yes. I said, I'll come aboard. I'll start Monday. Literally Monday, I'll start. All I need is a phone, an email address. It's a month to month. At the end of any month, you may fire me. I want a flat fee. I don't want any bonus at all. A flat fee, month to month, fire me at the end of every month. I won't be here any longer than 9 months, and I will find my replacement and train them.
Hmm.
No golden parachute.
Yeah.
Now, for those of you who don't know, if you try to hire an executive in a public company, it's at least a 3 to 6 month process minimum, usually a 9 month process. They're going to want a guaranteed 1 year. And if they fire him before, they're going to want a golden parachute. Blah, blah, blah. I was like, nothing. I'll start Monday. Let's go. Why did I do that? So I could have actual experience in leading. I could reorg. Organize. I knew how to do it, but knowing how to do it and having actual experience, two separate things. So I made it easy to say yes to me. And they did. And I did one of them on a handshake, not even a contract. Mm. No, sounds crazy. Please don't do that. But I'm just saying, that's how easy it was. I wanted to make it easy. I wanted to make it almost like, how could they say no? So I went in, reorged, fixed things, and then came back out. So I was doing all that kind of stuff. COVID hits, I can't do any of that. Mm. So my business shifted from about 20% coaching to 90% coaching almost overnight. And I do it because it makes money. But would I rather be doing other things? Yeah, I would.
I got you.
I would. So it did change my business model tremendously. It really did. And okay. Now I'm heavily coaching because this is what I can do. The problem is now as they begin to, you know, let stuff go and open up, now I got to reboot again. I got to go back out to the market again, right? What's my training again? What's this? What's that? So Now it's going to be a serious time for me to get back and actually doing other things.
Yeah, I took a similar transition when COVID hit because, as I mentioned, I was recruiting people and training them how to actually be financial planners. That was my career.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you sit down with a financial planner, you want to be face to face. You want to be kneecap to kneecap. It's very hard in my mind to do it via Zoom.
Tough.
It's just, you don't have the same energy. You don't have the same aura.
Yep.
The trust factor is limited. And so, but I know a lot of people in my industry are just killing it because now Zoom opens up the market to not just in your own hometown, but anywhere in the state or anywhere in the country.
Yep.
And so it's really interesting.
It's a different mindset. I agree completely. And we have to make a shift in doing that, right? And not just that, you know, you're looking at, right, what are you going to wear now when it comes to being in Zoom? What's your background, right? What do I want a mic? Do I want a headset? All those things. It's a whole new brand, right? If I'm showing in front of somebody, I know where I'm going, what I'm going to wear. Do I wear a tie? Do I wear a jacket? Do I have both? Right? What do I? You know by your environment when you're going there how you should be groomed, right? You get it, right? Certain places, you know, you got to be button up, suit and tie. Some places it's okay if you got the open, whatever, but you know, Zoom, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to know what am I doing? How am I doing it? It's difficult.
Well, like we said, I don't know if we recorded it, but we said at the beginning of our conversation that this is a new world. You know, if you're not on Zoom, then you're going to fail in business. Whether you like it or not, it's inevitable. Technology is changing. I mean, you said technology is leading finance, but technology is leading every industry right now.
Yes, that's true. Yes, absolutely. Good point. So, it's leading everything, 100%.
Absolutely. So, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about politics on this show, because that's where I met you. And that's what you're, I think maybe you're not known for nationwide, but you had a successful run in run for governor of New York State as a libertarian.
It's true.
And your story
raised $500,000.
Your story is very compelling. You know, I'm not going to ask you to repeat the whole story about how you came into libertarianism, because anybody who knows how to find you, they'll hear that story eventually.
Yeah, but I don't mind being lightly, because I covered a bunch of it, right? Robert Ringer is the one who actually got me into thinking in a liberty way. Mm-hmm. On top of that, 2008, 2009, as I began more of a leadership training, I started realizing that leadership now is post-industrial leadership. It's leadership that's not, you know, factory-based, which means I'm not so concerned about your arms and legs. I'm much more concerned about your brain. And I want to get your brain to the best of my ability. That's what I want. I want your brain to the best of my ability. And to do that, you have to want to be here. It's all about volunteerism, mm-hmm. right? Good leadership is about volunteerism. It's what it's all about. And so I began teaching that already. So when I heard Gary Johnson speak in 2012, I could hear him. Why? Not because he was a great speaker. That's not the reason. Because he was an entrepreneur just like me.
Yeah.
That's, I could connect on that level. And finally, I was like, oh, a politician who kind of gets me, a guy who built his own business, right? I was like, oh, okay, I can hear this guy. And I liked him right away. And that brought me to the party.
Yeah.
And then I joined the party in 2012. And then eventually I joined like the local group. And then I joined the state party. And eventually I joined the national, I think 2014 or 2015, I joined the national party. Maybe 2014, because I joined in 2012 and then I started helping our gubernatorial candidate, who was a guy named Michael McDermott. He recently passed away. Michael McDermott, who was our gubernatorial candidate in 2014. I actually helped him run for office. After that I was in, and then 2016, I ran for the VP slot. I lost to Bill Weld by 31 votes. Not that I'm counting. Who's counting? Michael, stop counting. I'm not counting. You're counting. Nobody cares. Anyway, 31 votes is what I lost that vote that by. And then I ran for governor of New York right after that, because I now wanted to be active. And I thought governor of New York was the right move for me for several reasons. One of them was I was considering leaving New York. Mm-hmm. I was seeing how bad the environment is. And this is before COVID.
Yeah.
How New York was being so oppressive, being so bad, hurting everybody I saw, crushing small businesses with terrible ideas and concepts. And I thought, you know what? Why am I here? So I actually was looking around. And one of the cities I was looking at was Charlotte, North Carolina. And because to do what I do, I have to have a relatively large city, right? Sure. Otherwise, with large businesses, otherwise I can't really make my money. Mm-hmm. So Charlotte's one of them. They're a relatively large city with some big businesses. Okay, I got a chance at having success in Charlotte. So I was going to go down there. So looking at homes in that area, and I was like, wow, I can sell my tiny home here in New York City and buy a mansion in North Carolina. Like my entire property here in Queens is 20 feet wide.
Wow.
Not acres, not yards, feet.
Yeah, a little bit more bigger than a jail cell, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, 20 feet wide. You can't get to my backyard that I have. My backyard is like a postage stamp. You can't get to my backyard by going through my house because the houses touch each other. So there's no way around to the backyard. You have to go through the house, get to the backyard because the houses touch.
Yeah.
That's where I live. So I can sell that house here and buy a mansion in North Carolina and pay less taxes. I got angry. And I said, why does my state suck? That's what I thought. Serious. That's what I thought. Sure. Why does my state suck? Why do I have to leave my family, my friends, my business, my associates? I'm born in New York City. I live in New York City now. Why do I have to leave?
It's in your blood.
Why should I leave? I don't want to leave. It's where I live. Why would I want to leave? I don't want to. So I got mad. Right. I'm going to do something. So I ran for office. So I said, I can complain all day if I want to, or I can leave, or I can do something. So now I complain and do something. There we go. Those are two I picked.
Well, I think one of the things that I really resonate with, it was your pragmatism as far as politics goes. Because, you know, in libertarian philosophy, a lot of people will say, well, it's voluntary philosophy, right? Don't hurt me. Don't take my stuff. But I don't really think there's a lot of answers that the libertarian message provides. And that's one of the challenges with the marketing of this this type of movement. It's like, okay, you're going to look for politics because there's a huge market demand in the political world. Whether or not it's good or bad, it just is. There's a market demand for answers. I think if you're going to run on some kind of ticket, you got to provide answers for the people.
Yes.
And that's why I really like what you have to say.
The thing, like, what I will give advice to anyone who's running for office. Number one bit of advice when it comes to running your campaign. Every week, have a policy team meeting. Every week, have a policy team meeting over anything else. I want you to raise money 100%. I want you to go meet people 100%. But if you don't have a policy meeting every week, you are going to be caught flat-footed in someone's conversation. You are going to fall back to silly libertarian propaganda pieces that work very well in libertarian worlds and fail outside of our worlds. But there's no tomorrow. One of the reasons why we do so poorly is we spend so much time around libertarians. So when someone goes, how are you going to fix healthcare? Libertarian goes, get government out. And libertarians go, yeah, oh, that's yeah. Everyone else goes, that's not an answer. That's stupid. Mm-hmm. The average American loves government. The average American thinks government's the answer for most things. Clearly, you saw it with COVID. The average American does believe that. Now, many libertarians get mad at me. Well, I don't care about the average Americans. You should. They're voting your rights away on a yearly basis.
Right.
You probably should care about them because they're literally going to be part of the police force that's going to come to your house and take your stuff. So you probably should care. That's just pragmatic, right? You probably should care about those people because sure. they're the ones who are going to do, well, I'm going to have a gun. Great. So you'll shoot a couple of them before they kill you. That's what that means.
Yeah.
Right. So you'll get a couple shots off before they take all your stuff. Well, I guess that's good. I'd rather you not shoot anybody. That's just my piece. So I want to get the people where they are. So I have two rules in my policy, and only two. Mm-hmm. No force, no new taxes. That's it. If any policy I've ever made, and I've made a bazillion policies, two things are always true. No force, no new taxes. That's it. But Larry, you got to cut taxes. We're just increasing taxes.
Yeah.
Can you just get me to a point where we're no longer increasing? Just can we go there first? Right. Yep. My whole point is there are a lot of people who are, you know, we don't need government. We don't need all these things. I'm not fighting you on the point. I'm not a pro-government guy. But I know we have to get there. Right now, we are marching as fast as we can towards oligarchy and or dictatorship. Mm-hmm. We are marching right towards it. Eagerly. This country's eagerly marching right towards it. I'm saying let's turn it around and face freedom first. Now, once we're facing freedom, let's have all the arguments on how far we go.
Yeah.
All of them. How far do we go? But we got to start marching that way first. Mm-hmm. We're not. We're going the opposite direction. And I'm saying turn the country around. Face freedom. Let's start walking towards that way. Let's start pulling things off. Let's start putting community back into our lives and pulling government out. Let's just start doing that. Yeah. And then we can decide how far we go. The problem is we spent so much time under the government boot that there are many communities who have literally lost the institutional knowledge to support themselves. And if you remove government, there's nothing for them.
Right.
Exactly. Get government out doesn't work when a community has been under the government's boot for 40, 50, 60 years and has lost the institutional knowledge to support itself. Mm-hmm. So let's start creating policies that will get people to voluntarily begin supporting themselves so government is no longer a monopoly. Right now, government is almost always two things, a monopoly and a jobs program.
Yeah.
That's what it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you have monopoly and jobs program, you take that monopoly away, there's nothing left and the jobs went away. Who's going to vote for that?
Exactly.
Who's going to support that? So instead, leave the government there for now, create a second or third option that is community-based, volunteer-based, as it begins to take up the slack voluntarily, The government has two options. One, get better, which means more efficient, do its job better, or two, go away. But when it goes away, the community is there to pick up.
Right. Exactly.
Voluntarily, we can pick up. That's the goal. Break the monopoly of government. What happens when those workers have jobs? That's why we have those community pieces to fill in those spots. They still have jobs, just not taxpayer anymore.
You know, some people say that technology might be the way out of that or into that transition you're talking about. Some people are talking about like Bitcoin and things of that nature. But are you planning on running for governor or anything again?
I might. There are two things I'm considering. I'm considering 2022 and considering 2024.
Okay.
In 2022, I'm considering running for governor. I'll decide this summer whether I will or won't. Depends on how much support I get, where I think the state is. I don't just want to run to get 4 or 5% or whatever again. It's not worth the run for me. If I run, I get angry at people all the time for not putting real campaigns together. I can't do that if I won't do it, right? My saying is always the same. I can't point my finger at you unless I point it at myself first. So when I ran for governor, I literally did not take a salary for a year and a half. I wrote a check to myself for $10,000. That's how I started my campaign, because I wasn't prepared to ask you for money until I put my own money in. So I wrote myself a check for 10 grand, then started asking for money. And they were like, well, you asked me for money? Yeah, I put 10 of my grand of my own money in. So now you can give me money, right? I'm showing you that I'm serious with my own cash. So now I can ask you for cash. But not just that. I didn't take a salary for a year and a half. I ran a full-time campaign and raised $500,000. Some people go, well, Larry, you know, I could run, but I might just show up once a month. Don't run. You're not doing me a favor. Well, I got a family. Then don't run. You're not doing me a favor. Mm-hmm. Run for real or don't run. And I can say that because I did it. So I'm not prepared. If I'm not prepared to make that full-time run, I'm not going to do it. If I'm ready to do it and make the full-time run and give it another year and a half and bust my rump, yeah. Because if I run, I'm going to be asking people for money and time and energy and everything. I'm going to come back on your show, all that stuff. I'm going to be doing all these things. I'm going to be bugging you for all these things. Well, I don't feel right bugging you for all these things if I'm not all in.
Sure.
If I'm all in, then I will ask you to be all in. But I can't do that if I'm not all in. So that's what I'll decide. 2024, a lot of people are asking me to run for president 2024. The odds of me doing that are slim to none. Being forward, the odds are slim to none. I would have to be the most popular libertarian in the country at the time. And I doubt I will be. If that were to happen, if I was the most popular libertarian in the country, I would consider it. But the odds, I think, are very slim of that. And the reason why is there's going to be no incumbent in 2024. Mm. I don't think Biden's going to be running in 2024. No incumbent means all the outsiders are going to flood the LP.
Sure.
To try to get our line. And you're going to have guys like Justin Amash, who's now an insider. Justin Amash is probably going to run. You're going to have the Tulsi Gabbards of the world try to run. You know, the Chafee, Lincoln Chafee of the world try to run. All the outsiders are going to start coming in trying to run, which means a lot of popularity is going to be there. I would rather take the VP slot for a popular president. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, maybe it'll be a Dave Smith, Larry Sharp ticket.
If he's the most popular libertarian at the time, maybe. Right. But the issue is whoever's the most popular libertarian at the time, and people say, well, Larry, is it only about populism? Not only. I mean, I want you to be a libertarian also. Right. Of course. Right. But the reality of it is, I think we should look at this seriously. The odds of us winning the presidency in 2024 are clearly slim. Possible? I hope we do. Obviously, crazier things have happened. Of course, I hope we do. But the odds are slim. I get that. But can we actually win a state or two? Much better. We could do that. But more importantly, can we get another spokesperson who will stay active in the party, who will assist those who are running afterwards at local levels? Mm-hmm. Now, I've already done that. I ran for governor in 2018 and lost. And then I covered the state again in 2019 and got 103 victories in New York State. We went from 2017 having zero libertarians to 2019 to having 103. That's success. So why would I be the VP? Because being the VP, if we lose, I'll still be more popular and I'll be able to go around and supporting people in 2025 and 2026, raising money for them, helping them out and getting them elected. That's why we're considering that.
Well, Larry, you're a man with a plan. You have very clear, concise ideas, and you have the charisma and positive energy that I think is needed in any endeavor.
Oh, I like that. Thank you, my friend.
So just closing, you know, what kind of advice based on our conversation today? I mean, we've covered a lot. What advice would you leave for everybody who heard this message today?
Most important thing is to follow me on the Sharp Way, all the Sharp Way internet things. I'm on YouTube, Instagram. I'm even on TikTok. I'm on Anchor with all my podcasts. I'm on Facebook, you name it. I'm on it. Check the Sharp Way. That's Larry Sharp with an E, and the E stands for entertaining.
There you go.
Sounds good. But in reality, the number one thing I would tell you though, to be forward, is that understanding that when things get bad, when things are not good, ask yourself three questions. Is this permanent? Is it permanent or will it go away? How will you think about this event a year from now? If the event's permanent, it is. Sometimes it is. Say if you say have an illness and you know have diabetes and lose a leg, that's permanent. I got it. So sometimes the event is permanent, but often it isn't. Ask yourself that question. Is it permanent? Second, is it pervasive? Does it affect every aspect of your life? Or is it just one part? This bad thing that happened, this event that happened, does it affect also your business life? Does it also affect your family life? Does it also affect your personal life? Again, sometimes yes, but not always. Having a fight with your boss doesn't mean it has to affect your personal life. Can, doesn't have to. Third, is it personal? Did someone actually come after you to get you? Or were you just in the way? If you can answer no to any of those questions, get back up. The world's not ending.
Is it permanent? Is it pervasive? And is it personal? I love it.
Yes. That comes from a book, by the way, Mark Seligman's book. Martin Seligman's book, Learned Optimism.
Awesome.
The three P's.
Larry, one final question. Are you Invictus?
Always, brother.
That's what I love to hear. I really appreciate the conversation. This was great.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You have a good day, and we'll hope to talk to you soon, okay?
Great.
I want to thank everyone for checking out another episode. I want to especially give thanks to Larry for coming on and imparting his wisdom. Whenever you cross paths with those specific individuals who demonstrate resilience, charisma, and leadership skills, I feel it is important to pay attention to what they are saying and the lessons they are giving. Pay attention to how they carry themselves in good times and in bad times, and try to pick up on the clues they subtly provide. I have found that success does in fact leave clues if we are open to receiving them. I also know that you will never find someone who is doing better than you that resents you asking them to teach, coach, or share something of value with you. And it is always someone who isn't succeeding that will disparage you, belittle you, or in some way knock you down. The liberty you are seeking lies in exactly how you react to the world around you. Though we do live in a political world, our reality comes directly from what we think, our attitude, and our ability to push through times when they are good or when they are bad. With those abilities, each of us can become Invictus. Until next time, keep learning, keep growing, be good, and stay free.